And he's on it.
A.J. Foyt has won his fourth 500-mile race.
It's a drag race. Marco Andretti, Cornish, who's going to win? At the stripe, it's home.
Goodyear makes a move. Little Al wins by just a few tenths of a second.
You just don't know what Indy means.
More Front Wings Centennial Interview Series.
Welcome back to another edition of More Front Wings Centennial Interview Series. On today's episode, we're very pleased to be joined by the winner of the 1986 Indianapolis 500, Mr. Bobby Rahal. Bobby, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Well, Bobby, of course, you had 13 starts starting in 1982 at Indianapolis, highlighted by the win in 1986. To start out, though, we want to go back to 1982 and see if you wouldn't walk us through some of your memories and recollections of your rookie year and coming to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway.
Well, there's a lot of them. For sure, it was for us at True Sports, which was a brand new team that had been started at in the fall of '81. Jim Truman, of course, was the owner of the team. And I originally came down in the fall of '81 to put the team together. And then we hired Steve Horn to be the team manager. And of course, we started from nothing. I mean, we didn't have a car, didn't have a shop, didn't have anything. And so over the course of that winter, the '81-'82 winter, we put everything together. And I had to go find the guys to buy the engines and the cars, and Jim was ready to put up the rest of the sponsorship. So I spent most of my time in 1981 chasing that down, which we were able to do. And we had Franz Weiss engines, which he was the best guy to do VDS, the best guy to do the engines for us. I'd known Franz for many years, I think we approached the start of the '82 year very professionally, but none of us on the team had any oval track experience. None of the mechanics, Steve Horn didn't, I didn't. Initially, we didn't even really have an engineer. Probably post the Phoenix race, the first race of the year, which was pretty much of a disaster for us. We hired Lee Dykstra, who'd been a famous engineer that had done work dating from the very early 60s, and Lee came on board and really sort of got us going in the right direction. But we went to Indy. As I said, our first race at Phoenix, I caught fire at the first pit stop, and that was the end of that race, and it was so chaotic, I think, that we didn't bother to go to the second race, which was Atlanta. And we really sort of prepared ourselves for Indy. Of course, I think my first recollection of Indy is doing rookie orientation, which was the first year they had it, and it was snowing while we were doing our runs. And I think that for sure going to Indy and actually going out on the track, I'd driven a lot of cars and different types of cars at that time, from Formula One cars to turbocharged Porsches at Le Mans, at Daytona, where the speeds were, close to 200 miles per hour. But I have to say, when I went to Indy the first time, and you get on that long back straightaway into three or into turn one at 200 plus, I mean, it's a whole new experience and frankly, a little bit intimidating. But we got through the ROP program pretty easily. And then of course prepared ourselves for the week and managed to qualify. It wasn't a particularly strong run, but it was enough to get in. And I've told many people that there was always a little bit of discomfort for me up until race day, and then during the race, all of a sudden everything kind of fell into place. I guess one of the best compliments I got was for a long time I was competing with Al Sr. He and I were fighting for position. I think we were fourth and fifth at the time, and John Cock was behind me, and after the race he went up to his mechanic and said, "Who's that guy in the number 19 car?" And the guy told him, he goes, "Hell, that guy was doing a pretty good job." So that really a third of the way through the race, all of a sudden everything just started to click for us, and I felt very comfortable there. And unfortunately we were running fifth, and we had an engine failure with about 15 laps to go. and still ended up 11th. But we were the top rookie at the time and would have been easily fifth place. And so it was a bit of a disappointment. But I have to say that, you know, after the race day, there was just a lot more comfort for me in the car. I think the team, everybody just kind of gelled, you know, during the race. And then the next race at Milwaukee, while we didn't finish, we had an extremely competitive race. We were running qualified fourth, I think. We were running, I want to say, second or somewhere like that. Had a failure, and suspension failure. But it all kind of emanated from the race at Indy in 82, where everything just sort of, as I said, just started to fall in place and make some sense.
Well, and things continued to improve for you and the team right through until your win in 1986, no doubt. Can you remind us of your memories of that month and walk us through what stood out for you?
Well, I mean, 86 was, you know, we'd won kart races in 80, you know, 82, 3, 4, 5. So we'd visited Victory Lane on many occasions during that period, and we had been competitive at Indy. You know, in 83, we were on the outside of the second row and you know, I think we actually led the race for a little bit. And in 84, we didn't have a super weak month, but still, you know, relatively competitive. 85, we were on the outside of the front row, led the race, you know, from the first corner for a long time and then had a mechanical. So, you know, we'd been competitive at Indy. And I think the only thing that kind of bothered me initially going in is that Adrian Newey had been my engineer in 84 and 85, and then he left the team at the end of 85 to go work for Craco, and which was Michael Andretti. And so I was disappointed because Adrian and I had been very successful together. But a guy named Grant Newberry, who'd been kind of an understudy to Adrian while he was with us, really kind of, he kind of segued into being the chief engineer, and Grant was a very sharp guy. In fact, later on, he went to Penske and was with Penske for many years. But in any event, you know, I think the overriding thing for all of us was the ill health of Jim Truman. You know, it was clear that he was in a very poor state of health. You know, in the winter, spring winter of '86, and you know. I think, I don't know if any of us thought we had to try harder, but I think, you know, you knew that this was the guy that, you know, created this team. This was the guy that brought all these people together, and this was clearly going to be his last Indy 500. And so we, you know, I think we all went in there, you know, wanting to win for Jim, but I think we all wanted to go in and win for ourselves, too. And I think we'd, you know, we frankly had a little bit of a rough start to the year that year. Hadn't done particularly well in many of the races, but we got to Indy and, you know, things, we had a pretty uneventful May, qualified fourth. The race, the car was, we led a lot of laps in the race. Myself and Rick, I think, led the most laps. And of course, you know, everybody knows what happened with the last few laps to go, but it was a pretty uneventful month. I guess the most eventful thing that happened was getting rained out the first weekend and everybody sort of standing around for 3 or 4 days. As I say, it was generally uneventful and pretty smooth, and the race was very smooth for us. And so in the end, we had the right car to win the race.
Well, Bobby, you started to talk about Jim Truman. Can you talk a little bit about what it felt like to stand in Victory Circle with him, knowing that he was in ill health, and then losing him a couple of weeks later, and the emotional roller coaster that must have been for you?
Well, it was very emotional for us. I mean, I watched the rerun not too long ago, and you know, I got choked up in Victory Lane when I said, you know, I knew all my best days would come with Jim, and you know, because he had been with me, he'd been a sponsor of mine since 1974 and a guy I'd known since 73. And, you know, Jim was always there for me. So it was a very emotional time, very bittersweet moment for all of us, I think, because as happy as we all were, there was a, you know, this dark cloud hanging over the whole thing. And, And for Jim, you know, for him to make it, to be honest, I'm surprised. I think it was only his internal fortitude and strength that got him to that weekend, because the weekend before, which was actually his 50th birthday or 51st birthday, you know, he was in pretty bad shape there. And then to wait another week, you know, 7 days doesn't sound like much, but in the health he was in at the time, or the ill health, 7 days was a lot. And you know, I think I think one of the kind of saddest moments really was after the race. He had a bus motorhome, and he was in it with a bunch of his friends, and normally there'd be a lot of hooping and hollering. And you know, I went in there to see him, and he was kind of nursing a beer, really not able to drink it, but just kind of had it. And there was just this, you know, I mean, what are you going to say? I mean, everybody knew what was on the horizon, and it was just I think Jim was very pleased, very satisfied, happy as much as he could be for winning. You know, I've seen the video of the winner's circle. And, you know, obviously he was smiling and trying to, you know, take it all in and, you know, and trying to be strong. But, you know, it took a lot of effort for him. And I look at photos and of us on the Corvette going around the track, you know, after the race. And he's obviously truly enjoying it, but obviously, you know, in very poor health. And so you look back, and it really was very much of a bittersweet victory. You know, none of us got, because it had been delayed a week, there was no prize, no black tie, no prize ceremony like they normally have. It was held in the backyard of the golf course there at the track, and it's quite informal. So we had none of the pomp and circumstance with it, but in the end, I think maybe it might have been one of the most meaningful Indy 500s, just because of the situation that Jim was in at the time.
Well, that's, to say the least, a very powerful story, and I greatly thank you for sharing that. Going forward after 1986, you continued on this kind of well-known roller coaster that you had, your even and odd years of doing well in the even years and struggling in the odd years.
Right.
Did your approach to the 500 in the month of May overall change after you had won the race?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I was with True Sports in 87, 88, 87. We qualified in the middle of the front row. Then we had a engine problem in 88, so we finished fifth with the Judd. Frankly, it might have been a little higher than that, but Mike Landretti's body work flew off his car with like two or three laps to go, and they, you know, we finished under the yellow. And I think I might have ended up fourth or third, but anyway. So, you know, but you're right. I mean, for years it was odd even. You know, I never did well in the odd years, and did always seemed to do okay in the even years. And it was that way, frankly, till 95, you know, when I finished third again. I was third in 94, and we finished third in 95, and that was the first good finish for us in an odd-numbered year. So at least we put that demon, you know, to bed before I retired. But no, I don't think I ever changed our approach. You know, I think I had... You know, there were times when we didn't, you know, we had equipment that wasn't as good as I think everybody else or most others. In 89, we had the Cosworth engine, which was not a good engine. It was powerful but unreliable, and sure enough, in the race, it broke very early in the race. You know, in 90, I had a very, very good race going. Should have, you know, we could have won it, but we had the front wing broke and gave me a lot of understeer, and Ari was able to get by me, but we still finished second. And 91, we should have won that one. I was almost a lap ahead of everybody. A lot of people had tire problems, and we didn't. And we had a mechanical, not quite within sight of the flag, but, you know, well into the race. So that was very disappointing, because I think we had kind of outsmarted everybody that day. But again, to answer your question specifically, I don't think you approach it any differently, other than maybe once you win it, you feel a lessening of pressure, you know, because it's kind of like your life as a driver is, you know, those who won Indy and those who haven't, and there's a big difference. So, you know, no real, maybe again, less pressure, but pretty much the approach would be the same.
Well, as you were going through your years right there, you stopped before you got to 93, and I'd be remiss if we didn't ask you about that. Coming, of course, to the Speedway as the defending national champion of kart from 2002, and you came with the you had purchased True Sport, and you came with your own package that year that,
right.
that you weren't able to make the race.
Right.
Having missed the race in 93, what did that do for your psyche of your overall view of Indianapolis? Did it make it seem more challenging or maybe understand the impact of it a little bit more?
I don't know. I don't think so. I mean, certainly when, we had a suite up on the inside, in the front straightaway there, and here I am watching, the pace lap, and we have our sponsors there, and it was very emotional for me because I said to myself, I don't belong here. I belong out there. And so that was very disappointing for me. I'd like to think that we took it in as much professional stride as anybody. I mean, I met with the press after we failed to qualify, and it didn't go run away and hide. I mean, I stood up and took my licks. And then, of course, the next race, we were fourth in Milwaukee because we went out and got a Lola, which we probably should never have done, the True Sports car, but that was 2020 hindsight. I mean, it had its pluses, but it had a lot of minuses, too, and I think after coming off the 92 year where we'd done so well, I guess we figured collectively that, we could do anything. And that clearly showed us that you can't do everything. So 93 was a very emotional, very upsetting time. But, did I appreciate this 500 afterwards as a result of that even more? Yeah, perhaps. Perhaps. I mean, I didn't realize that I would only have, two more years there, that the split would happen. And, I was, 42, and 95 was the last year I drove, and I retired at 45, so there could have been three more Indy 500s for me. Didn't realize that at the time. I think I always appreciated Indy. Maybe that appreciation's grown over the years because you just recognize the difficulty in winning it and just everything about it. But it's amazing. It really happened in 93. I think the biggest effect in 93 was when we didn't qualify there, to show you the depth of the relationship I had with Miller, they extended our contract 3 days after Indy, after not qualifying. They extended our contract. What a statement of faith in us and investment in us that made. And then the following year, when it became clear that the Honda, we weren't going to have the pace with the Honda engine for qualifying because we didn't make it in 93, I couldn't very well tell Miller Brewing Company, everybody else, that we're not going to make it for 2 years in a row. So really 93 kind of set the stage for 94 and for our eventual withdrawal from the Honda program.
Well, let's change the topic a little bit on you here. You had quite a long and successful career at Indianapolis, running from 82 to, you mentioned, the last race in 95 before the split, an era that saw such a great deal of talent at Indianapolis. Could you name a driver that you think was the best that you competed against at Indy?
Oh, I think Mears would have been the best at Indy, or on any oval for that matter. I mean, Rick was not only is he just a good guy. He was a guy that you never worried about. If you were running wheel to wheel with him, I think Al Jr. was pretty much the same way. Really, really good drivers, but clean drivers, intelligent drivers. I think by far those two would probably be the guys that would first come to mind. I just have the greatest respect for Rick and frankly for Al. Al was he was my teammate in 90 and 91. Al Jr. was a hell of a race car driver and just very, very talented. So I think those two guys, if I think of what comes to mind immediately, I'd say those are the two.
Well, that leads right into my next question, Bobby, because if you look at the drivers of the 80s and the early 90s, I think you and Rick Mears, more than any, are often considered the most racecraft intelligent, or at least the most tactical drivers of that era. Is there anyone in the IndyCar series today that kind of reminds you a bit of how you used to drive races, particularly at Indianapolis?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, let me think. I mean, I think Dario is very a very similar kind of driver. May not have the flash of a Dixon or somebody like that, but just seems to always have that, always know where to be in, at what time in the race. You know, it's not about leading the early laps, it's about leading the last laps, and I think if there was anything that I was maybe reasonably good at, it was knowing when to push the car and when not, and knowing where I had to be at what point during the race. So I'd say Dario is very similar to that. You know, I don't know, I'd probably have to think a lot more about that, but I certainly look at him as, even Helio's maybe won more races, I'm not sure Elio's got that same, although I will say he somehow manages to get to the front no matter where he's at, and so there's something to be said for that. But if I were to say there's one guy that reminds me of Rick or myself, it would be Dario.
Well, you've had the unique experience of driving at the Speedway in three different ways. You've driven as a driver, as a driver owner, and as an owner.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm not driving, obviously, but participating.
Right.
So. Those three different ways of participating in the race, how did your view of Indianapolis change depending on the role that you were in at the time?
Well, it's a lot more fun as a driver, I can tell you that. I mean, I think there are different challenges for sure. Being in the pits, seeing what's going on, you see the big picture, whereas when you're driving, you see your own little picture. And I think you have a much better appreciation of the race itself as a spectator, as a car owner, where you're on the radios, you're looking at what other people are doing, you know, the yellows, the pit stops, the strategies that are going on behind the scenes. So I think it's in many respects it's busier than driving a car. So I think that. You know, they all are kind of different. They all provide different scenarios. You know, I've always been asked what was more satisfactory, winning as a driver or as an owner. You know, as I tell people, it's really like apples and oranges. You know, they're both extremely satisfying, but it's a different kind of satisfaction that takes place, to my mind. I'm pleased that we've been able to achieve both. It is fun to, I do enjoy being up on the pit stand, calling the strategy and talking to the driver and just seeing everything that's going on. And you're always thinking about where you're going to be 10, 15, 20 laps from now. You know, as a driver, it's kind of everything's right now. It's whatever's right in front of you. So, when you're in the pits, you're really looking much further down the line than you are as a driver.
Well, Bobby, after the 1995 season, of course, that was your last race at Indianapolis because of the split. You weren't able to come back again before you retired. But when you did return to the Speedway in 2002 as an owner, coming with Jimmy Vassar that year, how did you feel that the Speedway and the event had changed in the 7 years that you had been gone?
Well, I mean, in 95, remember, 95 is the year that Roger didn't qualify in the Penske team. So here you have a guy that had dominated IndyCar racing for the prior 20 years and the guy doesn't make the race. And that just tells you, A, what a great race it had been, where there's no gimmies. I mean, there's no sure bets. I guess it gave me some solace from that, you know, we miss in 03 and he misses in 05, or in 93 and 95. And, you know, it wasn't to that level by any stretch of the imagination. And when we went back with Jimmy, I mean, the race is always competitive, but there was none of the, I mean, I don't think it had the the level of driver. It just wasn't the same. That's not the case anymore. I think in the last year or two or three, it's been as good as it ever was. But certainly, you know, it was in that rebuilding process in 03, and just progressively it's just gotten better.
Bobby, now, of course, you have a second generation of Ray Hall taking a shot at Indianapolis now with your son, Graham. Can you talk a little bit about how it feels to you to be standing on the sidelines watching him take a shot at the BorgWarner?
It's nerve-wracking. Yeah, I mean, it's horrible, you know, in part because I want him to achieve his dreams, and certainly winning Indy is one of them. You don't want him to have misfortune. But you know, and he's had some, I wouldn't call bad luck, because I think he's probably made some of his own bad luck in, you know, up until last year. But it's a thrill to watch him. It's a thrill to see him qualify like he's done. I mean, you know, his first year there, you know, he qualified, in 08, they qualified, I think it was inside of the third row, I think, and then he was inside second row in 09. And, last year we were inside third row, I think it was again. It might have been middle of fourth row in 08, but anyway, you know, he's qualified very well last year for us when he qualified fifth after the first go round and ahead of Briscoe and Dixon. You know, here we were a one-shot, one-race team, and right in the middle of the Penske group, and if anybody saw the qualifying run, I mean, he drove the wheels off the car, and it's just a thrill to see that, and exciting to see that. I thought he did a great job last year. He got, I think, unfairly penalized, but that's my opinion, and it cost us a real, I think he had a top three car, but in any event, you know, he finished, and it was good to get 500 miles under his belt at still a very young age, and you know, I think he's got the potential to have a long, very successful future at Indy, and it's nerve-wracking. It's never easy to watch a loved one out there driving a race car, because you don't really know what's going on, and of course you want to control it too. You know, you want to kind of drive the car for him, but you can't. But in the end, I think he's done a pretty darn good job, and I think he's just going to get stronger and stronger there, and I'm excited for him for this year. I think if the car is a good car, and I see no reason why it shouldn't be, I think he's going to be tough. One minute I'm biting my fingernails, the next minute I'm clapping.
Well, Bobby, we've covered a lot of ground today. I guess just in an overall sense here, if we ask you to come up with a favorite memory and a favorite or a least favorite memory, I guess, the greatest disappointment, would you be able to pinpoint particular instances for each of those?
Well, of course, I would say the least favorite would be not qualifying in Indy in 93. I mean, that was certainly very traumatic for everybody within the team. Just a horrible situation that I would not wish on, you know, my worst enemy, particularly, as you said, after coming off winning the championship in 92. Very humbling experience, and when you think you have things somewhat under control, then that happens, and you realize that it's a very fragile moment in time when you're, and a fickle moment in time when you're at the top. So that would probably be the worst. You know, I'd still have to say, you know, 86 probably was a highlight, the most obvious, just because of winning it. As I've told people many times, it's not often that you are able to achieve a dream for someone else, and that day we did that for Jim, and more so probably than for any of us. So those would be the two points that you ask about.
Oh, Bobby, just one more for you. In the 99 years that the Indianapolis 500 has been running, only 67 drivers has earned the right to call themselves a champion of the Indianapolis 500. What does it mean to you to be able to carry that title?
It means a tremendous amount. You're amongst a very select group of people. You know, when you look at the history of the Indianapolis 500 with all the triumph and tragedy and the human interest stories and the victories and the defeats that everybody, you go through as a driver and you read about others. And, of course, if you're a student of the sport, the people that were very, very good drivers and never won the race. And there's probably more of those than otherwise. It really, you truly understand the import of the event. And, so, you know, I would say that, just being one of those, 67, I think you mentioned, is a tremendous, tremendous amount of pride. And as I remember Danny Sullivan welcomed me in 1986, he said, "Welcome to the club." And I said the same thing to Elio the first time he won, and to others, to show the Farron. And it's a tremendous club and a very selective and exclusive club, and I'm honored to be a part of it.
That's great. Well, you've shared some really fantastic memories with us and really encapsulated what we're trying to achieve here in sharing the emotion of Indianapolis with fans of the race. So thank you so much for being so gracious with your thoughts and your time.
My pleasure.
And thanks to all of you for listening as well. Please stay tuned to more Front Wing throughout the month of May as we continue to speak with champions of the Indianapolis 500 as part of our centennial interview series. And remember that morefrontwing.com is your source online for blogs, photos, podcasts, and more covering the IZOD IndyCar series and beyond.